Word of mouth.
Sunshine, lollipops, and rainbows. Everything that's wonderful is what I feel when we're together.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Wherever you live, whatever you're into, human beings respond to music. Brain researchers have found that listening to music doesn't only make you feel good, it alters your brain physiologically. Dr. Robert Satore is a neuroscientist at the Montreal Neurological Institute at McGill University. He has been studying the ways that music directly affects the brain. Dr. Satore, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hello, Virginia.
So what's happening in the brain when someone is listening to their favorite music?
Really, a whole lot of different things are happening, which is part of what makes it really quite fascinating to study. But perhaps I can focus on the aspect which most people find the most relevant, which is that when you listen to a piece of music that you really like, that you love, it really makes you feel very good. Pleasurable music activates a system in the brain that we call the dopamine system. And this is a system which is associated with positive reinforcement or reward, as well as learning and other positive mood effects.
So it feels good. How did you know which music to play while you were experimenting with people? And how were you able to study the reactions in the brain?
So we used a technique called positron emission tomography, which is a way of measuring brain chemistry, basically. And this allows us to pinpoint not only which chemical is active, but also where in the brain it's active. And we took our participants, who were just healthy, normal, average people. We just asked them, well, what's your favorite music? If I'm being scanned, I would use, you know, my favorite music as the experimental condition, and I might use your favorite music as the control condition.
Mm-hmm.
And for you, it'd be vice versa, because you don't necessarily like what I would like, and other way around. So that's how we did the study.
Have you ever discovered any universals, however, about what sorts of music people do or don't derive pleasure from?
Well, there are some universals that lots of people have identified. The problem is it's not quite enough to predict, you know, this piece of music will be liked by this person. It's kind of like a recipe. You could say, well, we know that the kinds of things people like tend to be relatively sweet and maybe have a little bit of a creamy texture and have some fruit in them. That's, you know, a general description of a dessert. But does everyone like strawberry shortcake? Well, not necessarily.
I'd like to dig into that idea a little bit more, because we do know that human beings, for the most part, do crave either salty, fatty, sweet foods as a sort of something they developed evolutionarily for survival. Are there theories about what sort of evolutionary purpose music would play in the development of human beings?
That's a very good question, because unlike food, the one big difference is that you can't actually live without music. You might not have a very pleasant life, but you won't starve to death without it the way you would without having any food. And so one of the ideas that we're kicking around is that the reason we get such pleasure from music is because basically the brain can be thought of as a problem-solving engine or a prediction engine. In other words, we derive pleasure from solving puzzles, from understanding relationships, from seeing patterns in our environment, and from predicting what's going to happen next. And that does make sense from a survival point of view. If you are some kind of organism living in a certain environment and you can detect certain patterns that are out there and make predictions about what's going to happen, that will enhance your survival. And music can be thought of as a microcosm of that, to the extent that there are all kinds of different patterns, rhythms and harmonies and melodies and different kinds of relationships. And if you are able to perceive those relationships, you can also make predictions about what's coming up. So a big part of music is what musicians refer to as anticipation. So you hear a certain chord sequence, let's say, and you expect a certain chord to follow, and musicians will play with that by perhaps giving you a somewhat unexpected chord,
mm-hmm.
or by delaying when that particular chord appears.
Well, certainly not all music is designed for that dopamine surge or wash of pleasure that you get when you listen to something that you love. Here's a composition called Threnody for the Victims of Hiroshima. This is by the composer Penderecki. Listeners might actually recognize it from the film adaptation of Stephen King's The Shining. Okay, so it puts my neck hairs on edge. What does your research tell you about music that is purposefully dissonant, like this piece, which seems to be designed to make us feel uncomfortable?
Absolutely, and that is clearly the intent of that piece of music. So I would say that there are many different routes into evoking an emotional response, and pleasure is one very important one, but it's not the only one. And in some cases, the intended emotion is not pleasure, and that's true for music, but also true for many other styles of art. So in the case of that piece of music, for instance, it's highly, highly dissonant. People generally prefer consonant music. So if you have something very dissonant, by definition, it will be something that people find aggressive or unpleasant. If you look at a lot of music that is produced by and for very young people, you will also find a lot of dissonance, and that is consistent with the fact that adolescents are often, pretty sort of unhappy with their state, the way they see the world and the way they see themselves fitting in. And so they use music, and dissonance in particular, to express, their dissatisfaction, if you will.
We're speaking with Dr. Robert Zatoria, a neuroscientist based at McGill, about how our brains are quite noticeably and directly influenced by music. Here's another clip. This is one of those songs that gives me a chill when I hear it. Illinois Jacquette, he's playing Thelonious Monk's Round Midnight on an oboe. People get a dopamine response from different kinds of emotionally powerful music. I mean, why would we derive pleasure listening to a very sad piece of music or something that's angry? Emotions generally perceived as negative.
Well, I think that is an excellent question, and many artists will tell you that their goal is to put people in an uncomfortable place, and that certainly applies to music. The interesting aspect of music is that it's so abstract. In other forms of art, you can refer directly to an event or a thought or an interaction with a person, whereas music is just patterns of sounds, and yet they can also evoke sadness or fear or anger. Of course, we don't really know how that happens. It's a very active research area, but we do see that, for example, with music that people perceive to induce fear in them, we do see a recruitment of parts of the brain that are known to be associated with the fear response, like the amygdala, for example. A broader question is, why do people like to listen to those patterns? And I think this speaks to the sort of the complexity of the human mind that, we're not always happy. Sometimes we're sad. And to the extent that you can use music to elicit those moods and therefore allow you to reflect on your own internal response to those emotions, that can actually be extremely useful and extremely even uplifting.
I may be generalizing, but I have noticed that very, very technically gifted musicians are much more likely to be interested in prog rock or jazz or math rock, genres that use complicated timings and rhythms, like this song. This is a snippet of the song Atlas, and it's by the band Battles. So you mentioned earlier the kind of satisfaction of resolution of patterns, this advanced pattern recognition. Would music like this be satisfying to musicians for that reason?
I don't know about that particular piece. I didn't really care for it personally. But
I'm kind of with you on that one.
Obviously, a lot of people do, and it's interesting about the different time signatures because, you know, there's music in different genres over the centuries that have used rather complex timings. I'm thinking of, you know, Dave Brubeck, who famously wrote pieces in 5 or mm-hmm. in 11, but also Stravinsky, for instance, who had many, many pieces with extremely complex rhythms. And I think what's going on there is that as you, the listener, become more sophisticated in a particular genre, whether it be that style of rock that we just heard, or you know, contemporary classical music, or some kind of jazz, or whatever it is, you become better at recognizing those patterns. And to the extent that the patterns are more complicated and maybe more hidden in the musical structure, discovering them is even more of a pleasure. Because if a pattern is really very simple and very obvious and very superficial, well, you listen to that music once or twice, and after that, it'll be all over. You've discovered everything there is to be discovered, and it's now boring. And that's actually what happens with a lot of, music that's really designed for mass consumption, top 40 music or something, whereas music that stands the test of time tends to be, in large part, music that's more complicated, where the barrier to entry is much higher.
Music can differ so much from one place to the other. I'm thinking of, you know, the sort of complexity of a gamelan composition in Indonesia to, you know, an American or a Euro pop song. Very different kind of tendencies. Does that suggest that there's something different about those brains?
Yes, absolutely. So culture plays an enormous role in the way we understand music, similar to that of how we understand language. If you were brought up listening only to Indian ragas, you will develop a very good sense for what's going on in that kind of music. And if you did not grow up listening to that, you may not quite understand what's going on because you don't have the brain mechanisms that are required to decode those patterns. So it really comes back to this idea of pattern recognition. You have to learn how to recognize those patterns, and that learning occurs more easily early on. And in fact, there's a lot of evidence that very young children, even babies, they start to learn the patterns of sound in their environment, whether it be gamelans or Chinese music or Afro-pop or whatever it is that they're exposed to. They will learn that at the same time or even earlier than when they start to figure out the language that they're exposed to.
So music can alter the brain, like a drug might actually alter the brain. Is it the same in that way, in that addiction, in the sense that we are maybe always trying to find new music that will recreate that same burst, that same high that we got from the stuff that we used to love?
Well, there is an element of what we call association. So music serves very well to remind us of past events. But I think I'm more struck by the fact that people love music for its own sake. It is its own reward, as it were. It's not really linked to some external event. I think it would be an oversimplification to claim that music is nothing but a kind of a drug that you get high from and it makes you feel good and that's it. In fact, in our latest studies, we've been finding that, unlike drugs, what happens with music is that there's a very complicated interaction between those more ancient reward-related structures that are deep in the middle of the brain and these very evolutionarily recent and very highly advanced cortical structures where we have all kinds of knowledge stored. And I think, in a way, that's the essence of what music is. It's it connects us to the deepest aspects of our humanity while at the same time requiring a lot of pretty complicated cognition.
Dr. Zatori, I want to thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much, Virginia.
Dr. Robert Zatori, neuroscientist at the Montreal Neurological Institute, that's at McGill University. Much more about the work that he's done on music and the brain. Links are at wordofmouthradio.org. You made me very curious about what are the most played songs on your iPod.
Well, I have very atypical tastes. I'm an organist by training, so I sort of favor music that was written up to 1750.
inspired by the explanation of how music influences the brain and the emotions, we turned to our Facebook page and asked you for your saddest song of all time. Well, grab some tissues. We collected many of your suggestions and created the world's weepiest compilation. Here's just a 2-minute sample.
It's been 7 hours and 15 days. I was happy in the haze of a drunken hour, but heaven knows I'm miserable now. Go home, live with your pain, leave alone. Together we've climbed hills and trees, learned of love and ABC, and skinned our hearts and skinned our knees. Goodbye, my friend, it's hard to die without his lifelong friend. Puff could not be brave, so Puff, that mighty dragon, sadly slipped into his cave. Oh, you know that old trees just grow stronger, and old rivers grow wilder every day. Old people just grow lonesome, waiting for someone to say hello in there. Blackbird is swinging in the southern breeze, strange poplar trees. Don't you know my name? If I saw you in heaven.
He stopped loving her today. It placed a wreath upon his door. My city, old man, all tattered and torn, the forgotten heroes of a forgotten war. All the lonely people, where do they all come from?
Thank you so much for your suggestions. You'll find a full list of the songs and the artists that made the world's weepiest compilation on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we got so many that we couldn't fit them all. Did we miss any of your most potent weepers? You can let us know on our Facebook page, Facebook/wordofmouthradio.
Nothing can